Welcome to Hallow Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. This study explores the Torah reading Kitavo, covering Deuteronomy 26, verse 1 through chapter 3, 29, verse 9, and parallel passage in Isaiah 60. The first fruits offering reveals God's desire for our hearts, not just our outward obedience. It reminds us that despite our struggles and feelings of worthlessness, God values us deeply. Tithing further demonstrates how we are to share our blessings with others. Yet the sobering curses in this passage warn that internal rebellion against God has severe consequences, even to the point of our doing unthinkable acts. These passages call us to examine our motives and align our hearts with God's heart. When we do, the prophecies of restoration reveal the bountiful blessings that await those who wholeheartedly return to the Lord.
In Deuteronomy 26, we turn back to Deuteronomy 26, and we'll discuss this a little bit. So first of all, it starts out the first 11 verses or so, mostly subject to timing or timing by writing the first fruits. So for those who are not familiar with the first fruits, it's obviously in our Torah. It talks about a few different spots in our Torah regarding this topic. And the topic intent is to be that when you produce a product, some kind of a fruit product, like a tree product or whatever, the first item, the first one that's first that is ripe for that season is given to God. And that's God's, it belongs to him to do with what, how he sees fit. And in this instance, he chose first fruits to all belong or all end up going to the priests that serve in the temple. I want to pay attention to this first section. So in the first 11 verses, they talk about a storyline or a spiel that the gentleman who, or woman, man, whoever has to bring this first fruit up, they're supposed to say to the priest as he goes through his talk. And it's a little bit interesting as far as how he discusses it, but he has to come, as it describes, through the first few, first comes the priest, he has to declare that he didn't, that he's come to the land, this is the great things God's given me, that kind of thing, all discussed in verse 1 through 3. And he's going to lay before the priest, and then the priest takes the basket of his hand, waited for the altar, so now it belongs to God and the priest to then use. But at that point, the man starts saying out this interesting narrative, a storyline. Now, this story is translated a couple different ways in different texts from Hebrew to English, and they're not all the same. Some translate this a little bit different than others. And they have different translations for a certain reason. They mean different things. But what I want to bring out to you today in this one portion of the Torah, we have other topics to talk about as well, is there are some interesting connections God's making in this description of this narrative that the offer of first fruit is saying or reciting. So I'll read it out to you again, just as it was just read, and we're going to discuss a little bit about what some of these symbols mean and how they are tied visually to our minds as we're discussing first fruits. So jumping down to verse 5 of 26 of Deuteronomy. And then you shall call out and say before Yehovah your God. Now I'm going to read this in the Art Scroll translation, which is different than English typically, but bear with me. I'll discuss it in a minute as to why. And not that it's right, it's just different. Before the Lord your God, an Aramean tried to destroy my father. He descended to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great, strong, and numerous. The Egyptians mistreated us and afflicted us and placed hard work upon us. Then we cried out to Jehovah, our God, of our forefathers, and Jehovah heard our voice and saw our affliction, our travail, and our oppression. Jehovah took us out of Egypt with a strong hand, the outstretched arm, with great awesomeness and great signs and with great wonders. He brought us to this place. He gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now behold, I have brought the first fruit of the ground that you have given me, O Jehovah, and you shall lay it before Jehovah your God, and you shall prostrate yourself before the Lord Jehovah your God. You shall rejoice with all the goodness that Jehovah your God has given you and your household, you and the Levite, the proselyte who is in your midst. So that is a rendition or variation of the Hebrew to English according to Art Scroll. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. In most translations, which is also legitimately equal, points out that my father was a wandering Aramean versus a Aramean turned to my father. Those are two different versions of the same thing, which we'll talk about a little bit about that. So first of all, I want to bring to you, this is a rhetorical question, don't answer this, but think about it. There are a lot of symbols being discussed in this narrative that the man or woman is supposed to recite. A lot of different things being talked about. And I have a question for you, but we're going to discuss a little bit for the next few minutes, about why God wanted these symbols brought forward in this first fruits description, this first fruits offering. So first of all, we have a few things to write up on my board here. A few of the topics that we're going to discuss a little bit as far as symbols being recited in this Torah portion, in this narrative, the gentleman or man or woman who is reading out. So obviously he talks about initially the Aramean. So we'll hear the Aramean. So whether Jacob was the Aramean being referred to, or whether in Jewish tradition the Aramean refers to Laban, that's a matter of debate. It's a faith item, not a specific detail. So the Aramean, so what is an Aramean? A person from Aram. Now we know, obviously, Abraham was from Aram. They're all descendants thereof. But the Aramean, in this instance, is either going to be Jacob, oops, that's a C, or Laban, depending on your personal perspective and how you read the text in its translation to English. And I'll leave that to your decision, how you choose to read it. Because it doesn't really matter. The topic's the same. What I want to point out to you is that Aramean does not have he's a place that was, had a place. So an Aramean is from Aram. Well, Jacob, of course, was not from Aram anymore. He was born and raised in the Canaanite territory. That's where he came from. Laban, of course, still was from Aram. But I want to bring this attention to you is that whether or not discuss it in two different forms. The first form, assuming that the destruction is the topic they wish is the Aramean as Laban. We'll discuss this briefly because it's totally legit. It could happen. In this instance, we have the Aramean tried to kill Jacob. So we have a scenario where Jacob is going to be, or was supposed to be, or Aramean attempted to kill him. And we have that, of course, recorded quite thoroughly in the book of Genesis when Laban came to try to kill Jacob and all of his descendants, or not, to take the household because he was fleeing Laban. So we have that full legit. That's a legit argument. That's fair. What's being discussed here is one of the interpretations. But in this case, the contrast, I want to bring the contrast that Jacob, if the translation is correct, and that the Aramean tried to destroy Jacob, well, we also, the same contrast being discussed here, that Egypt tried to kill Jacob too. So when we have a comparison in this storyline that the Aramean, assuming it's Laban, tried to kill Jacob, we also have the Egyptian, which in this case would be Pharaoh, also tried to kill Jacob. In this case, obviously, the descendants of Israel. So we have this scenario, we're comparing both instances where, if the Aramean destroyed my father is the correct translation, both instances where we have somebody else attempted to kill our ancestry, right? Either our parents, meaning Jacob or the descendants of Israel. The idea is that we the people of Israel, in the case of this, the first fruits, is contrasting the idea that, hey, we have, no matter where we go, someone's trying to kill us off, right? Whether we go back to where we came from, Aram, they tried to kill us. Go to Egypt where we don't actually belong, they tried to kill us. So wherever we go, that's not where God put us, because God didn't put them to live in Egypt forever. Egypt was not their inheritance. God did not give them Aram's inheritance. So wherever we go, that's not where God put us, someone tries to kill us. That's the idea behind it in this storyline. So it's a mental contrast of the person who's offering this first fruits at realizing that, hey, this first fruits was a blessing from God. It's from the land that God gave me. But if I was anywhere else, I would be dead. Right? That's the idea. Wherever else I go, if I don't acknowledge the land, the value God gave me, it would result in my death, which is very consistent with Christian believers, same principle. If you aren't following Messiah in some capacity, guess what? What's your destination? The destiny? Well, some form of death, however you want it to look like. So the idea is the same principle, but we're to contrast that no matter where we go, someone wants us dead. That's the idea in this imagery. This is not the only one we're discussing today. This is just one of them. To make sense so far? Hopefully it does. Now to on the other version, that the Aramean was Jacob and not Laban, which is totally fine too. The exact same scenario can be discussed. In this case, the Arab man being Jacob, if he's just a wandering person. So in this case, we have the wandering. So Jacob being a wanderer. Wanderer. Is it two? I didn't spell wandering. A wandering person, in that he doesn't belong in wherever he goes. It's the same principle that we just discussed about the destroying person. Destroying, whether Laban tried to kill him or not, regarding the wanderer. And that wherever Jacob goes, he's a wanderer. He doesn't belong. So he does not belong, not in Aram, because he was wandering, and not in Egypt. So it's also the same principle being discussed, the same imagery we're talking about, that I don't belong. So before, it was wherever I go, once and once we dead. In this case, there's no place I can go. I don't belong anywhere else. So this is the same imagery we have for this first fruit. So this first fruits, God's trying to get us to picture this in our mind, that what we have and the blessings God gives to us is very specific. It's designed for you specifically as an individual, but as a follower of God, that wherever else you attempt to go, it doesn't work. So note, this was first fruits in the land. They weren't supposed to do it in the wandering wilderness. They weren't supposed to do it in Egypt. This is just in the land. So wherever we go, again, if it's not the land that God selected for us, we don't belong. It doesn't work. So we lose. We're a wanderer. We don't belong in Egypt. We don't belong in Aram. There's no place we belong. So it's also not just a destruction thing. It's also a belonging thing. I should write these things down. So the first idea is destruction. Oh, to destroy. And the second concept of wandering is belonging, where the word belong up there. So destroy and belong. These are two visual imagery we're having of just a simple phrase, right? We're not done yet, though. There's more to this than what God is giving us in this imagery, because we're supposed to be reading these things and understand the idea of what God's trying to convey. Well, the next point being talked about is that this has been contrasting with the land God swore to our fathers. So we have this land. So we erase this other part of here, the Aramean part. And Aram part, and we're right at the next part of the land. Again, so the land, we have the land that God promised. The land is the land of territory of Israel. That was the idea of the promise that God gives to him. Now they have this contrast of the land given to God, given to the children of Israel, versus where they came from, which is the land of Egypt. The land of Egypt was a discussion matter. Egypt. And it's not their land. So we have the same idea being talked about in this narrative, of this idea of where I once was, not mine, to where I am now, which is mine, the promise of land. So it's also belonging thing, but it's also possession type concept. Because they didn't get to possess Egypt, they got to possess the land that God gave them. So in this case, we have the contrast of land being discussed, of where we once were, the process where we once lived and survived and lived, not very well, but survived in Egypt, compared to where we're given, where God's giving us this now your space. So you have the land ownership. Rather room here. I'll put land. Just I'll leave it as land. I'm better move on my wiggly squiggly lines. So the land topic is also being discussed again because God gave it to them. That was the idea that this is your possession. You have a place that is yours. So in the same narrative, we have this idea of destroying being discussed, the idea of belonging being discussed. Because you're not a wanderer. We have the idea of the land being discussed, all in the same exact narrative. And God's tying them all to first fruits, which is interesting. We also have, of course, the next one is God saw the treatment. So we also erase this part because we're going to go through this really quickly. We also have the treatment being discussed. So how Egypt was treated them. So the treatment, which of course it describes was harsh. For all the words being discussed. It was oppressive, harsh, oppressive, and what were the other ones? Oh, afflicted. So mistreating, afflicted, and oppressed. So harsh or mistreat, afflict, oppress. These are also imagery we're being discussed is while they're in Egypt. So it also picture a mind of harsh treatment or oppression, being crushed. So I'll do the oppressive here because that's the dominant player here, because all those fall under the category of oppression in general. So yeah, there's another imagery for us being discussed here. And then we have obviously the last one of God fulfilling his promise. So erase the treatment idea. God fulfilling the promise of the actual land itself, the fulfillment of God's agreement. So fulfill the agreement. And that is the idea that, hey, we brought God to that was promised to us. Now God actually fulfilled, he actually accomplished what he said, as opposed to just leaving it as empty words. So he gave Abraham words, but Abraham didn't see it. He gave Isaac words, but Isaac didn't see it. He gave Jacob words, but Jacob didn't see it. Those are just words until they actually get fulfilled. So we have also this discussion that actually God's fulfilling his agreements. The agreement is true. So we'll call it a true agreement. Agreement. Let's say spell agreement, maybe. Oh, whatever. It's close enough. So we have all these imagery inside this idea, which this guy is citing. There's probably some other imagery too. We're about to see every single image possible. And all of them are focused around the idea of first fruits. First fruit. Why? The question is why? Why would God want me as an individual to have this piece of fruit or grain or whatever I'm offering to him and the priests and say, okay, this is a great thing I have here. And I'm supposed to be thinking about in my mind, I was potentially being destroyed. I didn't belong anywhere. This land, which wasn't mine, it's now a land that belongs, that should belong to me. I used to be being oppressed, and God now is fulfilling all of his agreements. All of these imagery is supposed to go through my mind as I'm looking at this first fruit item to hand over to the priest. So I have to ask, why does God want this? Why does God want me to think about these things as I'm offering this first fruit item? What's his objective? What is his ultimate goal in this? So I have my opinions, of course. We have a few other things to discuss about this same conceptual idea, which is talked about in our New Testament authors, discuss a similar topic, not regarding fruit and land, but the same idea of a first fruit concept. And so in this discussed, we also have the idea that we learn from Apostle Paul that we have this Yeshua being a type of first fruit. So we also have the first fruit example. Paul explains a little bit, not extensively, of course, that Yeshua was a type of first fruit. He was a first fruit of the dead. That was his job, his functionality. He was a first fruit of the dead. And that he also, Paul also reiterates and adds on to that, that people or individuals, we'll call it people, are also a type of first fruit of the Spirit from God. So not only is Yeshua the first fruit of the dead, but people themselves are the first fruit, also the Spirit from God. So each of these items are also first fruits. But I have a question for you. The first fruits are supposed to be offered to God. That's what Torah says. The first fruits is offered to God. It's given to God. That's their job. That's its function. So if I'm thinking about these things, the destroyed, that I was could have been destroyed, I didn't belong anywhere, the land that was in was not mine, I was oppressed, God's fulfilling the agreement finally after all these hundreds of years go by. In this case, probably the guy being talked a few hundred years goes by before God fulfills the agreement. And all this is supposed to be focusing on give to God. I'm giving to God the first fruits of this process. That's the idea of what I'm doing in this action. Now, in the case of first fruits of human beings, you should the first, the dead, for us, first fruit of the dead. So the first person of dead of man, we'll call it, because man dies. So first fruit of the dead, and then I myself also supposed to be a first fruit from God, or the Spirit from God. That's how I become a first fruit. And this is also supposed to be given to God, because all first fruits give to God. Give to God. So every type of first fruit belongs to God to do with, as he sees fit. Usually the priest is how he's physically doing it, but that's its functionality. So first fruits, if I'm supposed to be thinking about these concepts of essentially, if I was going to aggregate these ideas into one concept, one conceptual idea, the idea of destroy, I didn't belong, the land, I was oppressed, now God's filling a true agreement, is essentially, I'm growing. I went from where I didn't belong to nothing, to near death and near wasteless or worthlessness, to something that God has valued. So he valued me. So I would argue that these types of things, because many people get destroyed, happens all the time. People die for tons of reasons. A lot of people wander around lost. Look at the homeless population. There's millions of them, right? I don't belong anywhere. I didn't know what land it was. Yeah, that's, again, homeless population, good example. People oppressed or mistreated, happens all the time. But the ultimate end of this was this last concept of God actually fulfilling his agreement. I truly mattered. In spite of all the reasons why I shouldn't matter, the destruction, I don't belong anywhere, I'm wandering, I don't own anything, nothing's mine, people oppress me, I shouldn't matter, God shouldn't care. But God did say, actually, you're right, but I do care. It's the actual point of being important enough that God says, yeah, I'm going to make this happen. That's an interesting idea. So if I have this is how I would view it. You may view it differently, it's how I view it. That God actually said, you actually mean something to me in spite of the fact that from all outward appearances, you don't, right? You don't mean anything in outward appearance, if somebody's ready to destroy you. Clearly, I've no value to the individual who's trying to kill me, right? They don't want me, they don't care about how value to me. I want me dead. I have no value to the person who says, hey, you don't belong here, kick me out. You're a wanderer, you don't belong here. I have no value to the person who says, this is not your land, this is mine, get off it. I have no value to the person who wants to oppress me and says, hey, I don't care what your gripes or opinions are. I have no value to others, individuals. And I could theoretically come with the idea in my head, I'm no value to anyone. That could come up to my, it totally could. If I had these examples of my existence, I would have an image in my mind that I don't value, I'm not valuable to anyone. No one values me. But then the very end, God says, actually, you do. I value. God does. So that's how I would view the first fruit concept. Is that it goes from a, because the citation of the storyline goes from all these very negative, terrible things. They do. It's all these bad things happen. They do terrible things. There's this narrative this guy has to recite. And they're all designed to remind you of negative things that happened in the past. That's the idea. To remind you of all these struggles, these difficulties, these reasons why you should have died and you shouldn't matter to anybody. But the very end, God's up. Nope. Change of thought. Change of plan. You do actually matter in spite of all those difficulties, in spite of all those struggles and failures. So that's the imagery I would mind get in my mind with the narrative that, that the church, the person has to recite when they give their first fruits. And I'm acknowledging God is the responsible party because I'm giving the first fruits. In the case of the first fruits of the dead, same principle. Look at Yeshua's life. Just look at it. I'm not referring to all the glorious miracles he did, because how was he treated? Like garbage. Pretty bad, right? That was not, I mean, they tried to, how many people have tried to stone you? Well, no one tried to stone me that I know about. I haven't tried to, how many people have tried to crucify you on a stake or cross? What do you think it happens to me? Yeah, it hasn't happened to me yet. Maybe it happens to one of you someday, but not to me. Very few of us have gone through the misery that he went through. Would we not conclude he was cursed? He was bad. Bad things happened to him. If you observe those things to any ordinary human being, say, well, yeah, obviously God's not protecting that person. They're on their own. God's abandoned them. That's a normal reaction. If I look at these items up here, I say, yeah, God doesn't care about this individual. No reaction. If you look at Yeshua as a man, he even said, God, take this. This is too hard. I can't handle this. This is too much. But still, your will be done. So even Messiah is realizing, yeah, this is awful. This is a terrible experience. I don't want this, but I will acquiesce and do what you ask me to do. So even Messiah pointed out that, yeah, this is awful. This is a terrible experience he's going through, which is, again, the same idea of here, this idea I have over here when I'm reciting this narrative for the first fruits. I get the same picture of this is awful experience. I wouldn't want to go through that. But the end, I point out that God points out that, hey, I actually mattered and he fulfilled the agreement. And in Messiah's case, the end points out God resurrects him. Okay, he fulfilled the agreement. So even though it was a terrible experience getting there, the ultimate outcome was the goal in Messiah's case. Again, also same principle happens with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob with the promise God gave to him. Even though the principle, the storyline of getting there to be terrible, the ultimate goal is the outcome. That's the objective. So even though these are hard, the objective is the outcomes. The outcome being truly valuable to God as you as an individual, and God resurrecting Messiah to resurrect as he come and afterward, God makes him king. So resurrected, then of course becomes king, which is fine. So this is the ultimate goal Messiah is going to go through. So he's looking at the difficulties. Hey, even though I have difficulties, my ultimate objective, my ending storyline is what actually matters, how I end. Now the people themselves, first through the Spirit of God, at the time of the apostles, how great was their life? Everybody partied, got a good time. Life was wonderful. All the priests said, yay, you guys are awesome. We're all going to follow you. Yeah, I don't think so. It was a pretty tough life too. They were persecuted, trying to be slaughtered, killed again. And from the outward appearance, it would appear negative, wouldn't it? If you were an outside observer watching what's happening to the believers going at the time of Messiah and shortly thereafter his death, what would you conclude? Not someone who was following Messiah or following the Jewish way of life or following the Roman way of life. Just observing the events occurring and happening upon the individuals who are following Messiah. You say, yeah, they're cursed. They were actually called the poverty-stricken ones. That was the old Hebrew name for them. The ones who were pathetic. Another term. They're the wasted, the worthless ones. So they were actually considered pretty bad off and they were treated pretty horribly. It would not be in your carnal best interest to follow that process, your eternal interest. But what was their objective? Their objective, again, wasn't the experience of process going through. What was their objective? The outcome. Joy has a question here. Almost like baptism. You worry about it. Yep. And your outcome. You still go through difficulties. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right. So she's pointing out, exactly, she's pointing out baptism is kind of similar. You have difficulties, you have ideas you don't belong, struggles in life, that type of thing. And you get baptized, you agree with agreement, which is great, wonderful. But it doesn't mean these difficult things go away. They don't. But she points out, they don't hold as much power over you as they once did. You're a little bit less concerned about some of them, maybe not all of them, less concerned about some of them than the power they once had. I mean, so we still struggle about some of them. I'm not lying. We still live, we still struggle at times. Yeah, but this is have a hard time. We still may get oppressed. But the oppression doesn't feel as intense as it would be if you did not have the agreement, right? So Messiah's intensity that he had to go through, I'm willing to bet, because it's the same for all the human beings, for him probably as well, it's not as bad as it could be because he has his end goal in mind. And the people of God, first fruits of the Spirit of God, also given to God, again, the intensity of their oppression, though it's bad, is not as bad as it could be because they have their true agreement that they're looking forward to. So it's the outcome is the goal. So this first fruits idea, I have these, I remind myself of all the miseries I went through to get here, but I got here and God finally gave it to me, what I was after. That's the idea, imagery I have at least of first fruits, conceptual idea. Does it make sense? Hope to lose anybody. If I did, chat up now because I'm moving on to the next topic. I happen to like the topic of first fruits. It's an interesting discussion matter in more aspects than the short rundown I just gave. So that's a pretty short rundown. So in this discussion matter, it will also discuss, it moves on to tithing ideas. So we have a different concept of tithing and it, thank you, good there, versus first fruits. So first fruits was an acknowledgement or an honor of, hey, God, I made it. I got the end. I got what I was after. And you rejoice amongst the Levites and everything. But the idea of first fruits is you're giving them to God. You're giving this to God as acknowledgement that you did it. You gave me what I was after. I'm giving it to you as acknowledgement. In case of tithing, we're not going to spend as much time on tithing as we did on first fruits, because this is a shorter topic matter, is that unlike first fruits, because first fruits you don't give to ordinary people, you give it to God. Tithing you give to people. So there's a sharing of people in the form of tithing. So God essentially divided up the idea of tithing and first fruits separately. So first fruits over here, roots, and tithe over here, there is some crossover. There is some sharing back and forth on certain topics or certain events or scenarios. But the majority of it's divided up this way. First fruits is pretty much all God's to do with as however he sees fit. He wants to share it with somebody, you know, throw it away, whatever. Whatever God wants to do, it's his on first fruits. On tithe, most of it actually is not really God's. A small percentage of it is. The majority of tithing is actually shared with people. Share with people. Now, obviously, not just any random human being. Share with people of God, more specifically. So tithing has its own category versus first fruits. First fruits belongs strictly to God. Everything is his. Because of tithing, it's not that way. A large percentage of it is shared with people. This is more of a, and the tithing has its own objective. The objective of tithing, as it's described here in our Torah portion, the objective of tithing is that if I tithe, that God will bless me, my land, with more than I just had this past year. So bless the next year's better than the previous year was. And the idea of getting that tithing is that blessing is that you share what you did get from God with those who are participants. So you have the poor, the widow. You have Levi still in here. That type of people who you're sharing your tithing with, in the case of tithing. Yes, you also give a solid percentage to God as well. I think it's 10% of it. It goes to God as well, but that's the majority use of tithing. Yeah, there's holidays in here too, but all of them center around people in general. You're sharing and distributing and utilizing your tithe and celebrating with a bunch of people. In the case of first fruits, you also celebrate as well, but not with the first fruits. The first fruits all go to God. Your celebration is separate. I have bad penmanship. You celebrate with people as well, but the case you celebrate with people, this is you may bring other food items, for example, your other resources to celebrate in the case of first fruits. You don't get to use the first fruits itself for celebration. In the case of tithing, using the tithe, a part of the tithe, that's part of the celebration part as well. So you also celebrate here, but in here you're celebrating with all the individual poor people versus over here on the first fruits, you're celebrating with those who are the proselyte and Levites. Possibly with those strangers, people who are trying to follow God. That's their idea. So God divided up separate two different things, two different imagery going on here. Our first was we had this idea that God, it was all God's, but that God finally fulfilled what we our promised land was, our promised idea was. And tithing is, hey, God has fulfilled it, but now I'm going to share it. It's a progression from thank God for filling it, first fruits, to now God, I'm going to share it, tithing part. Make sense? That's the idea, the image we're having in this Torah portion, storyline. Hopefully it didn't lose you too much. I'm not spending a lot of time on tithing because that's its own topic, but this is the image you were getting in our Torah portion versus thank you, God, compared to now share. And the idea of tithing, as it's explicitly stated, is that if you do share, God will bless you with more. So you get more. That's the idea. You're sharing so that God will bless you and your territory, your land with more than it had the year before. This is explicitly described, so we know exactly what that says. There's not really a question regarding it. Let's advance forward a bit here. I won't go through every concept that we discussed here. We have other examples of people being first fruits and such of God. Israel is described as a first fruit of God. We have Ezekiel describing that as well in different parts of how their discussion. So we have these ideas of first fruits. Now we have this, we're advancing forward in our Torah portion because we advance as soon as I can, to a little bit of the Haftorah portion because it's relevant in this. Even though it's not technically attached to it, it is still relevant. So in this, So in this Torah portion, the tail end of 26 and going to 27, we have these curses and blessings showing up, right? And those aren't really pleasant things. The blessings are, but the curse is not so good, right? They're the kind of negative curses. Our family got through this twice now today, once at HRCC, the church here, and then now here at Hella Fellowship. It's a pretty negative, you know, depressing, awful experience being discussed here about the blessings and the cursings. And I'm going to erase this because I hope this is not part of this blessing cursing category per se of tithing and first fruits. So let's move on to blessings and cursings. We'll note the majority of our Torah portion has or talks about the cursing aspect. That's the majority of it. Yeah, there's a blessing section. We have this cursing part discussed, the tail end of 27, the last, you know, two-thirds of it or so. And what's being discussed there compared to the blessing side, there's a little bit of blessing, the small section 28, and then we go on this long list of awful experiences of all these curses and the consequences that come with it, page after page after page, all these horrible, horrible scenarios. A few things to your attention, my attention as well, is that in 27, we have these cursings, versus bless. The cursings in 27, if you know, there's a basic theme behind pretty much all of them. Actually, not pretty much. Let's scratch that. There's the same theme amongst all of them. It's the exact same thing. And what is that theme? Secret. See, if I sin against, you know, Joe Schmo, he may not like me. I may do something bad to him, whatever the bad thing is. I did something, or I stole something, whatever. I did whatever it was to Joe Schmo. And Joe Schmo's upset. He says, hey, everybody, look what Daniel did to me. And he's just blabbing about all, and it's very open. Everybody's going to find out I did something bad. Everybody's going to find out what I did. I'm guilty. They all know I'm guilty. So it's pretty obvious. I get shamed, which is a very intense, powerful emotion, by the way. I get shamed, which is more intense than even anger, than versus as opposed to if I did something in secret. Now you notice most all the chapters 27 curses, the things you should curses, it does this, that, the other thing, they're all based on secret. They're private things. Things you could do and get theoretically get away with without anybody else finding out. I mean, this is a bad question, technically. How many of us talk about all of our sleeping conquests? Most people don't, but some people may advertise it. Generally speaking, we don't talk about all the people we slept with. That generally, I realize that modern day American culture is very different, and generally it's not supposed to be discussed that way.
Yeah.
So, and the fact that four of these 11 curses are all about who you slept with. So that's an interesting topic that these are personal private things that you wouldn't normally advertise. The idea of setting a pagan graven image, right? And it says in a secret place, so no one knows about it. Ooh, my Buddha downstairs in the basement. Ooh, right? Those types of things where it's all that no one knows about. Well, those are all secret things. You don't advertise them. So the idea is that if I did something openly, what would normally happen? Well, I get arrested. There's a trial. I'm found guilty or innocent. there's a consequence, there's a payment, whatever goes with it. That's an open sin, open treasure, an open offense against somebody else. Anything secret, who finds out about it? Theoretically, no one. Oh, God does. God, you're right. God would find out, but nobody else, no person does. I don't experience the immediate consequence of that secret sin, that secret transgression, right? They're quiet, they're personal. And I bring this up because imagine for a minute, because it is secret and people are people. We've been doing this for a very, 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 very long time. In the outside, we're good and holy, but on the inside, we're not. Don't raise your hands, but you can think in your mind the number of scenarios which this you've run across this, whether your personal life, somebody else's life, I don't, it doesn't matter who it is, but you've experienced these types of experience. You can imagine what this is like. Ezekiel talks about this in the imagery that God gives him, that he takes him from, I forgot the name of the river. Anyway, the river in near Tel Aviv, all the way back into Jerusalem, the symbolic, not Jerusalem physically there, but God had put inside his imagery this vision of Jerusalem. He had to open the secret walls and all these people of Israel that were looked good in where Ezekiel was living outside were actually worshiping and bowing down to pagan idols that were stuffed in the walls of Jerusalem, the holy city, actually, the temple. And the idea being that says, hey, on the outside, these guys look great, but on the inside, they're rotten and disgusting. But who knows about it? God, that's it. Nobody else knows. And that was Ezekiel. There's a lot more things in Ezekiel's imagery than just that, but that's the imagery we're supposed to be given. So the idea is that secret things don't necessarily look bad on the outside because we don't necessarily see them. Someone could totally deceive me really easily. I'm not that bright. So, but when it comes to inside, I wouldn't know. I just assume you look the same inside and out, you're good, right? I have no clue what the person actually is. So an inside secret, the only way that person gets corrected or dealt with by God is that God is the one who has to curse them. God's the one who has to deal with them, correct them, handle their scenario, or teach them differently, whatever it is. God's, because I can't do it. I don't know. But God knows. That's the idea. So we have these curses being rattled off to us because they are internal curses. They're internal situations. Scenarios are inside of persons, not show up on the outside. And that's a big deal with our God, is that not just what we look like and how we act and treat other people, is although that's very, very critically important. If we're rotten on the inside, why would God want us? What good are we? Have you ever bought a fruit? Like, for example, a watermelon, right? That's a good example. Watermelon looks great on the outside. It's beautiful. Take it home and it's rotting, right? Was the fruit any good then? Well, it looked great, but it wasn't any good. So the inside really matters ultimately, because when you eat the watermelon, what do you eat? You don't eat the outside skin. Well, I don't. Outside skin, you know, looks great. It's the inside you're after, right? I guess maybe some animals will eat the outside skin. I don't know. But it doesn't taste good. It's good for, like, you know, pigs and chickens, because it's terrible for you. So truthfully, as Messiah pointed out, again, the same thing with the whitewashed stones, that type of thing. On the outside, you look good, but the inside, you're empty. Clean the vessel on the inside. Yeah, all those symbols we're getting over and over and over again from Messiah and from Torah and Tanakh. It's the inside is the ultimate matter. So when God's discussing cursing people and what your problems are, say, really, we know what the Ten Commandments are. Our goal here is, what are you made of? Who are you? What is the inside that actually matters? That's what God's interested in. I could argue, you know, Joe Schmo, who looks terrible on the outside, but he's a good, honest person on the inside, I may perceive him incorrectly. I may perceive him as something that he's actually not. I perceive him as a rotten, horrible, you know, maybe he's a, I think he's a drug dealer or something. Who knows? Whatever it is. I can perceive something or think, oh, he's of low value, but on the inside, he's great. Now, I've also purchased some fruit. The outside looks really highly questionable. I don't think that's a good idea to eat that. And open up, no, I was dead wrong. Just totally dead wrong. So I can totally be perceived very easy from the outside. I'm sure all of us can be to some level. So we have tricks and such, but doesn't really help us. The idea is that holy on the outside, you know, that may be fine, but the inside not being holy or being holy is the actual ultimate goal. Make sense? No questions? Good. So hence why he spends so much time in the curses in this chapter, versus the blessings, because curses are internal curses. They're internal problems. Then they go through all these, I'm going to go through all the curses. They're quite, as my wife said, they're very depressing. All the curses are rattled off as far as the disobedience, all the things that God's going to happen to you. And historically speaking, we have both written in Baruch's writings. Baruch wrote books or writings independent of Jeremiah, by the way. Baruch was a scribe. He actually wrote stuff outside of Jeremiah. So he wrote some of his own personal observations of the time period which he was living. So he wrote some of his stories down, what happened that Jeremiah did not record. He said, hey, guess what, guys? And just wrote stuff down. We have his book. Well, not in our Bibles, but it's a separate topic, separate book item that he wrote, or supposedly wrote, that discussed the things he observed. And they are actually really close to what's being described here in Deuteronomy, right? So Jeremiah describes some of this stuff, not in intense detail. Baruch describes even more and reiterates that, yeah, actually, here's some more stuff that Jeremiah didn't tell you, and writes that stuff, like gossiping almost. Tell you a story. So Baruch wrote a few down. Pretty much everything in this entire section, which is horrible, disgustingly gross and depressing, yeah, pretty much all true. It pretty much all happened. And we think to ourselves, it was discussed today earlier, which is interesting, the idea that the cannibalism that takes place here, which is, we think to ourselves, I would rather die. Okay? Death isn't that bad. I'd rather be dead. How hard could that be? So I'm going to eat my own kid. Forget it. I'll just die. And the discussion matter, they just studied and done some narrative information. Now I can't say extensive studying because it's not really common. But when somebody is in extreme starvation mode, right? This was brought up in our church earlier today. Their rational thought process stops. Your rational thinking, the clarity of mind, the sound mind ends. So it just shuts down. And so your rational thought would say, I would never do such a thing because right now I'm not starving. But if in the true starvation mode, your rationality dies. So not dies, sorry, it shuts down. That's more accurate. It can be restarted, of course. So it's important for those of us, not that we've ever experienced that kind of starvation level of, you know, but heaven forbid, but if for some reason we do, it's important for us to know and trust that, okay, God, I can't always control when my mind is no longer in control. I can't make decisions well or even halfway tolerable if I have no control. So I need the sound mind of God to step in those scenarios. That to trust that I'll have a sound mind in difficult situations that I myself am mind without work or cannot function clearly on its own. And it was brought up, obviously, the Unbroken book, which is a very famous book now, just been around for a couple decades now. Regarding that exact topic, that individual starving, one went crazy and didn't make it, but the others found God in the process of their starvation, which is interesting. So they didn't make that horrible of a decision. So it's really interesting as far as how our minds work. And so even though we look at this text, like, how could anybody ever think to do that? In fact, when it comes to minds, when we're starving, we aren't thinking. That's the point. Your thinking shuts down. Your rational thought shuts down. So these are pretty bad scenario. Hence, the whole point is why God said, now, since your mind's not going to work anyway, I'm going to write this down for you. So when this does happen, you have to read, and your mind doesn't work. So, oh, wait a minute. I'm going through that today. So why is that? We'll go back a few verses. Oh, that's why. Because our rational mind isn't working well, but we can say, why is this happening? And we're going to read about it and plan accordingly. That's the idea. So God writes down these things that we would never think of them naturally. They're instinctive to say, I'm hungry, let's eat my kids. That's not the first thing that comes to mind. I would hope not. Some of us are. Okay, peanut gallery may not be. It may be different over here on the side. But most of us naturally would not come to such a conclusion. So hence it's written down. So it's pretty awful, but the idea is the inside matters. Now, what I wanted to bring up to you, which I have a few, actually I'm out of time. Well, just a few highlights real briefly regarding our Haftorah portion, because it doesn't talk about this directly, it talks about the polar opposite, in that this is a disastrous scenario. This is disastrous. For you going into starvation and curses, the terrible things, this is a disaster because your inside is bad. Your inside's awful. And that's what God's going to have to address. Our Haftorah portion, Isaiah 60, which Jeff did all the themes for the dancing, the songs today, which is pretty cool. I like Isaiah 60. And the song's pretty good. So well done, Jeff. In the case of Isaiah 60, it talks about, okay, these are bad things and God corrected and cursed and damaged and did all these bad things to us in order to fix us and make us not do that anymore. And it didn't work for a while, but eventually it does work. And then Isaiah 60 comes and says, now that we've fixed the inside, the curses are now gone. The outside is not the relevant part. The inside was. The inside is no longer a not good. Now it is a yes good. God addresses the inside. Now we're whatever. Now Isaiah 60 picks up, and a lot of chapters in Isaiah talk about the same topic, about the restoration. So now everybody comes back. All the peoples, of God, the Israelites, they all come back, and God brings them back, which is distinctly different, though. The Holocaust returners were a part of, but they're definitely different than what's described in Isaiah 60. But they come back because Isaiah 60 discusses this. Okay, now we're going to return to Zion and be a real community of obedient followers of God. This is what Zion is. Zion is a spiritual concept, not a physical location per se. It's that a city or a town or community is truly following God and God's ownership of them. That's the idea of what Zion's supposed to theoretically be. It's located in Jerusalem, but it's not Jerusalem itself. So they all come back, and all the blessings are restored. Lots and lots and lots and lots of blessings. Many of them record here in Deuteronomy, in our chapter Torah portion, but also other blessings included. And I want to point this, this which I thought was interesting to me, maybe it's not to you, but it is to me, is that these Isaiah 60 describes something which is distinctly different than our Holocaust returners. So those of you who have seen the videos, the Holocaust, and the people return to Jerusalem or Israel, or what do they look like? Still pretty scrawny, poor, devastated people, right? That was pretty much the appearance. And there's a reason for that, because all their wealth was taken from them, right? You saw the Holocaust survivors, some of them have seen photos of them in Auschwitz, or not Auschwitz, that was a pretty bad one, but other places. That they're emaciated individuals. They're very, very, very poor and bad condition on the outside, which we discuss outside and inside, but we're discussing the outside initially for now. That's all we can see for ourselves. So the outside, Isaiah 60 talks about a return, but the return being talked about, they don't bring themselves. Who brings them? Isaiah 62 means that who's bringing them? It's not that they are returning on their own accord, like there was for the Holocaust survivors. Who's returning? It's the nations who are returning them. And they're bringing them. It says, what's going on inside the people of God determines whether the Yerushalayim they are dwelling in is Zion or Sodom. Yeah, exactly. Very well said. your inside matters as far as what Zion will look like. It's the idea of being a light to the nations, as Isaiah talks about, light, rise, shine, be a light, his light is shining you. You can be a good light or a bad light. You don't want to be the bad light. You could be, either way, you're a light, but which one's good or bad? Don't be the bad one. but the nations are bringing them back, nations. And they're bringing back in a form of almost like an offering. An offering, a pleasing offering to God. So the people being brought back, all these people coming back, the nations bring them, not Israelites, but nations bring them back, and they're being treated like they're offering. God's pleased with them. So the people of the nations are realizing these people are awesome now. Not so they always were, but they are now. They're awesome people. And this is what God wants and desires. And unlike the Holocaust, they bring them back with all their stuff, comes back with them. All their gold, all their silver, all their possessions, everything they own comes back with them, which is distinctly the polar opposite. What took place with the Holocaust returners to Jerusalem and Israel. So in their case, the nation they were leaving purposefully stripped them of all the possessions. Russia's a great example, right? So you want to go, find all your stuff, your money, your gold, whatever you have stays here, you get your clothing and get out. That's what you got nothing else, just the clothes on your back and you get nothing. Doesn't matter how, whether you're a millionaire or a poor pauper, you get out, nothing goes with you. So they stripped them in those instances because the nations didn't value the people, they valued the stuff. In Isaiah 60, they stopped valuing the stuff and they value the people instead, which is interesting. The nations themselves recognize that the blessings that are listed in Torah and everything else is all based upon the people themselves, their inside value. God says, I want those. And all the nations of the world recognize God wants those. They're the best we can possibly offer. These people we're going to give to God. as well as here's the wealth that goes with them and everything else that starts flowing into Jerusalem, the territory of Zion, which is ruled by the called the city of God, as well as the, it's also called the Zion of the Holy One, which is Messiah. So because Messiah is the king. So we have all the stuff returning. So Isaiah 60 is the blessing part that is in part discussed in Deuteronomy, but also it's a continued blessing that the whole nations realize that the blessings are what matters. And they all focus upon the blessings. It's all blessings. The inside, all being goods, all blessings. The blessings all depend upon the people themselves. That I'm going to return and restore these people. They are what God actually wants, what he has always wanted, an obedient people that follows what he asks them to do. So Isaiah 60 is a glorious return and a metaphor, of course, of how all of this storyline comes together. Isaiah 60 was not necessarily tied to Torah portion for this reason, but it does have some elements that could be we can learn from this Torah portion, as well as how God is utilizing the imagery we have in the both with the first fruits, with tithing, how we're sharing obedience to God, God's fulfilling his actual promises he promised to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, on both not just the historical events with the Holocaust returners, but also future events includes all their wealth and possessions to go with them as a blessing too, which is very pretty awesome how God's doing this. So that's kind of what I want to talk about today. I didn't cover everything, but I covered the majority of it. So hopefully gave you a general idea of the difference between first fruits versus tithing, how they're distinguished from each other. It gives you a general idea of what God wants us to have on our minds when we're in the form of first fruit offering versus in the form of tithe offering. They have different thought processes, different objectives in mind. And all these actions are how God blesses, and these blessings are an external blessing that God's bringing to us, but it's all dependent also upon the internal well-being of the individual. So the internal part matters. I can give all the first fruits I want. I give all the tithe I want. If I'm a wicked person inside, that doesn't mean a whole lot. On the other hand, if I'm a good person inside, all those things do mean a whole lot. They all become valuable and important. So the outside becomes valuable when the inside is good too. Does that make sense? Hopefully it doesn't. Sam, you have a question or comment? Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a comment. So when we look at the blessings and the curses, I believe God is not kidding. Because when we look right. further in the scriptures, he did happen. You know, yep. it did happen. When we look at the Second King chapter 6 from verse 24 down to 33, that curse of eating your own, the fruit of your body did came yep. to pass, literally. So God wasn't kidding when he was saying that. And the chapter that followed after that was God showing the mercy, as just as the curses said, if you do return to me, this is going to happen. And the outcome of what preceding the punishment of cannibalism was that the idolatry, moving away from God, doing all these things that he told them, because the king that sit on the throne back then. And so I look at this as if, okay, this should be the after, you know, this part, right. this portion here, because I agree. because it's been overlooking several times in my time that I've, you know, been in the Christian and then in the Messianic. It's always, but I always have, okay, I think this should be the after, you know, that to read that, not just to focus on. I don't in the Judaism, they quickly gloss over the curses because we don't want to dwell in it. But we have to just look at it. There's consequences for our action. And yep. we can look at this in the biblical time or the time we are living now that the children, the generation of ours, all these things that we see going on in our time right now could be the part of the curses that we see. The children are being disobedient because, you know, we might say we are not under the law, but the law of God remains. It's there. It can be changed whether we like it or not. So if we move away from being, you know, evil and all that, The blessing is the outcome. Mm-hmm. So, and I believe that's what we should be striving, working towards. But to let the children also know, all of us to know that God is not kidding with this thing. It did happen in the scripture. And people did kill their own child and boil them and ate them. Literally.
Yes.
In the scripture.
Yep. You're absolutely right. I would agree that it would be better if the Haftarah included that section. Because it actually explicitly describes it. It's a real thing. It's really happened. And it's not that it can't happen anymore, because that's not true. It totally can. That this God can repeat these awful things at any point in time based upon what we choose to do or choose not to do. So we choose to abandon him, as Sam's going to point out. There are scenarios and situations in our own kids, we were talking about this earlier today, that these types of things are not, we're not at that extreme by a long shot. But there are elements that are creeping their way in that could totally return us the exact same cursings again. That rebellious concept that we have, and so it's a God screw you type of idea, I'm going to do this anyway, that's still within inside of us. And they could have these exact same struggles. Yes, it was that Jerusalem 70 AD, as correctly pointed out, it did happen. So these events are not foreign concepts. They totally can happen. They are real. They are true. God doesn't lie to us. So they did happen. They can happen. They can still happen again. I am praying and hoping they don't. That's pretty awful. But it is important that we watch our actions and our behaviors. They truly, truly matter on the inside.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.